I'm Frank Stacio.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today.
It's Here and Now.
A national assessment of student performance, widely viewed as the nation's report card, has found that test scores for charter school students are lower across the board than students in public schools. That finding is something of an eye-opener, since charter schools have been touted by the Bush administration and others as one solution to failing traditional schools. Chester Finn, Jr. is president of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, a nonprofit education reform group. Finn is also former Assistant Secretary of Education during the Reagan administration. Chester, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
This has to be pretty disappointing for supporters of charter schools. I would imagine they have largely been viewed as an alternative, the best alternative perhaps, to public schools, which are often described as failing.
It's not cheering, but it's expected, and it's not deeply disappointing. A lot of state tests had shown similar results before these national assessment results came out. And I think these new results, while sobering, are properly thought of as a baseline against which we should be monitoring future progress for charters as for regular public schools.
Well, how do you account for them?
How do I account for the fact that their performance is not what it ought to be today?
Mm-hmm.
First, many of them are new schools that are still getting their sea legs. Secondly, the kids attending them are both disproportionately poor and minority, and are also kids who were often behind the education eight ball before they even got to the charter school. Their parents opted into a charter school because the kid was having a desperate problem in his or her previous school. So the playing field didn't start level, and it's not going to be level by fourth grade for many of these kids. We also know from other important studies, such as the Brookings Institution, that charter schools do appear to be adding academic value to their kids, boosting their scores faster than regular schools, even though the absolute score level is still lower than it ought to be.
Well, and in many public schools, as you know, there's a lot of emphasis these days on teaching to the test. Do you think perhaps that is done less in charter schools?
I don't want to excuse low math and reading scores. The charter schools are adding value to their students, many of them. Some of them are not very good schools, Those that are adding value haven't yet got their kids up to the level they need to be at. But once again, this is a baseline for monitoring the future, not a basis for judging schools that in many cases are themselves just a couple years old.
Well, that is the question, isn't it? How do you determine the good charter schools from the bad charter schools, and what do you do about the bad ones?
Well, the good news about charter schools, even though the newspaper wants to make it out to be bad news, is that ineffective charter schools actually can and do get closed down. You don't persist with them. They typically have a five-year charter to operate, and at the end of that period, if they have failed to deliver the goods, they don't get their charter renewed. And somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 charter schools in America out of 3,000 have closed their doors. That's not a tragedy. That's a good thing. Bad schools should not have a permanent existence unless they get the job done. I wish that our regular schools were similarly subject to this kind of accountability.
As you know, some critics of charter schools are saying that the Bush administration didn't want this data out there because it challenges its support for charter schools.
That's just ridiculous. These data have been on the government's website for months, and nobody got around to doing anything with them until the American Federation of Teachers decided to use them to make some mischief, which, in fact, they've done. But these data have not been hidden. They've been out on a publicly available website for months. Nobody did anything with them. Incidentally, it's not a Bush administration initiative any more than it's a John Kerry initiative. His platform and speeches call for more charter schools.
So what are we missing here? What's the piece that that people most need to take away as they look at these figures?
Well, two things is what people need to take away. Two things are what I believe people should take away. First, that you can't pass a summary judgment about any educational institution from one round of test data. And it may be a clue, but it's not a verdict. And secondly, the charter schools, like regular schools, need to stick to their knitting and work on academic achievement harder than some of them have been doing.
Chester, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Nice being with you. Bye-bye.
Chester E. Finn, Jr. is president of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, a nonprofit education reform group.
New York City's police and firefighters say they'll be a strong presence at this month's Republican National Convention as demonstrators. After 2 years without a contract, unions representing firefighters and police say they'll gladly use the convention to highlight their dispute with New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. What they want is higher wages, and they say that means more than the 5% raise over 3 years that Bloomberg is offering. Bill Murphy is covering the story for Newsday. Hi, Bill.
Hello there.
What is it that the police and firefighters want? 5% is not enough.
Sure. There's no specific number they give out. You see all sorts of crazy numbers. What has been said publicly at this point by the unions is, let the city start getting to the cost of living, and then we're in the right neighborhood. And the cost of living these days is not 1.3% a year.
Yeah. Is there any chance they'll get it?
I doubt it very much. There is some relationship between what the workforces earn. And if a police officer earns something, a firefighter pretty much earns the same thing. So to then spread this across police, fire, sanitation, teachers, and all the other municipal workers, that would probably be a budget buster to go to for inflation.
There was a similar dispute in Boston between the firefighters and the police and Mayor Menino. Now, they did settle at the last minute. Is there any chance that this is just a question of brinksmanship and this thing is really going to be settled in the last week or so?
I don't think so, but it's certainly a possibility. With these kind of things, nothing gets done until it has to be done. You don't paint the garage until you have to. And I think that's the case here. Will it happen? It will happen, I think, in large part if we get here what you had in Massachusetts, namely the political will to fix it before the convention. If that happens, I think they can work out a deal. I think it's unlikely, but maybe I'm not the best one to make that guess.
Well, you know, when you talk about things having to happen, I guess you're talking about the pressure points. There are certainly security concerns. I mean, that would be one of the main issues. Is the mayor worried that the city might not be safe enough with this dispute going on?
Anybody would be reasonably concerned about security. He has taken the public position that firefighters and police officers are going to do their job, and I presume that they will.
From their point of view, though, police and fire, I guess, have to be very careful about how they put this. They certainly can't say they're going to withhold their jobs, that they're not going to do their jobs during the convention.
The police and fire are pretty much precluded from taking any kind of job action under the state Taylor Law, it's called here, which prohibits strikes by public employees. The one time there was an actual full-blown strike was in 1980 when the bus and subway workers went out. And the penalties against the union and its individual members were backbreaking. The union didn't recover for almost a decade. So there is a real hammer hanging over the heads of the unions and their members if they, in fact, do something that's illegal.
All right, so they can't do that, but certainly these are the heroes of 9/11. That's something we're going to hear a lot from the Republicans. That's in part why they've chosen New York. Can't they use that as a bargaining tool?
Oh, the firefighters and the police officers are playing that for all they can. But it would be a little bit out of sorts for the Republicans to come into town and say, oh, yes, give public employees more money. I don't think that's a message that's going to resonate very well in the heartland, that you want these New York people to be getting more money, especially from a Republican, moderately conservative administration that preaches the value of small government.
I bet the police and firefighters wish they could trademark their images because we're going to see a lot of them promoting the Republican agenda at that convention.
That is kind of interesting because I'm sure that a lot of the delegates that come here from out of town would like nothing better than to have a picture to take home with the New York City firefighter or police officer saying, you know, look who I met, this guy was at Ground Zero on 9/11. And at the same time, they're coming to town to meet them at a time when the police and firefighters are at their angriest.
Bill Murphy, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Bill Murphy reports for New York Newsday. He joined us from New York.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation is knocking on doors to learn whatever it can about possible security threats to the Republican convention. The FBI has created a list of individuals it believes could have information about plans for violent or criminal demonstrations. But many of the people on the list say they're simply peaceful protesters. The American Civil Liberties Union is accusing the Bureau of harassment, warning that the investigations could have a chilling effect on demonstrators exercising their right to free speech. We're joined by Sarah Bardwell, an intern for the American Friends Service Committee in Denver, who was visited by the FBI last Thursday. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us first, what happened when you heard this knock at the door?
Actually, my roommate was sitting on the front porch when they came up, and they told him that he could either talk to them by himself or with the rest of us there. So he went back and got us, and we were shocked. There were 4 FBI agents and 2 Denver police officers.
And what did they say to you?
They told us that they were doing preemptive investigations into people who they thought would be planning criminal activity or know about criminal activity for the RNC and the DNC and the inaugurations, and they asked us basically if we were planning any activity, criminal activity, if we knew anybody who was, or if we knew anybody that it was a crime to not tell them, and we declined to answer their questions.
Mm. Was it scary?
It was really scary, mostly because, not because I felt like my life was in danger, but because I just kept thinking, how is it possible that we have the FBI showing up at our house essentially to intimidate us out of exercising our First Amendment rights? And, like, what is the country coming to if that kind of thing is allowed?
Well, it sounds as if you kept your wits about you long enough to say, I'm not going to answer without a lawyer present. Did you then go get a lawyer?
Yeah, immediately afterwards I contacted Mark Silverstein at the ACLU. He's been collecting reports from people that were interviewed on that same day and from a man in Fort Collins who was interviewed by the FBI. And we're just trying to keep track of what's going on and see if they're doing anything wrong that's illegal. But under the Patriot Act, it seems like that type of activity is illegal. And I think that's where the real question is why is it legal for something like that to happen?
Mm. Do you have any idea, Sarah, why you and your roommate specifically were targeted for this kind of questioning?
Me and most of my roommates have been involved in the anti-war movement and other social justice activities in Denver and have been outspoken about that, about the police brutality that's been happening in Denver. But other than just their political activity and expressing their First Amendment rights, some of which have been to express that they oppose some of the government policies, I don't really see any other reason why they would have showed up at our door.
And do you think in any way this is going to affect your future plans, if there are any, for civil disobedience?
I mean, I think that if anything, it's strengthened my belief in community organizing, especially in light of the police brutality and the police abuses that have been going on locally with the Denver Police Department and the spy files. It's definitely strengthened my commitment to working against those kinds of social injustices.
Sarah Bardwell is an intern for the American Friends Service Committee. She spoke to us from Denver.
Just ahead, the latest on a crowded shelf of political books, but this one's aimed at the elementary school crowd.
And later, we check in on Iraq and ask, are you getting the news you need?
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Frank Stasio.
I'm Gail Harris.
Here and now.
With the presidential election only a few months away, political books abound. From tell-all biographies to history and thrillers, there's no shortage of literature to satisfy the political junkie. But what about all the Americans who are too young to vote and probably not very sure what this election or any election is all about anyway? Well, that's where Eileen Christelow's new book, Vote, comes in. Aimed at the elementary school crowd, the book and its cartoon illustrations not only explain what an election is, but also why it's important to vote, what happens if you don't, and even what happens in a recount. She joins us on the line from Dummerston, Vermont. And Eileen, why a book about voting for kids, especially this young, because clearly it's going to be years before they can even register?
During the last presidential election, I was in Hastings, Minnesota, and there were posters all over the schools for Gore and for Bush and for Nader and for pepperoni pizza. I asked the kids what was going on, and they were all obviously really intrigued with the election, and they'd been talking about it, and the teachers had started them off voting for their favorite pizza, and then they were talking about the candidates and voting for the candidates. And then I was there on the actual election day, and the kids came to school wearing buttons saying, I voted. So I said, well, where did you vote? And they'd all gone down to the local polls and voted, knowing that they could get this pin. They made sure to get their parents to go to the polls. And they had a special kids voting section, and the kids' votes were all counted. The newspapers told how the kids voted as well as how their parents voted. And this town, Hastings, Minnesota, apparently had a very high voter turnout. So I asked the teachers what books they were using, and they had no books and not a whole lot of materials. And so that's where the idea for this book was born.
Hmm. You chose a fairly light style for the book. It's a cartoon story about the election of a mayor, a woman, I might add.
Yes.
How did you test it to make sure that it was clear and accessible? And what's the reaction you've gotten?
The first test was really showing it to my editor, who said, you need kids in this. And so I went back to the drawing board, and I drew this little girl, and she was holding a sign. And it said, Chris Smith is the best. She's my mom. And so then I decided, okay, that girl is related to this mother who is running for mayor, and I figured out who it was going to be, who was the election was all about, and took it from there. When I sent the dummy of this book to this fourth grade class, the kids liked the book, so it was tested that way, but they really wanted to know whether Chris Smith, my mayoral candidate, was a Democrat or a Republican. And this was a problem because I didn't want the book to be partisan in any way. And I have tried the book since with third and fourth graders in Washington, D.C., and it went over really well, and it went over in ways that I hadn't really expected. After I read the book, the kids wanted to vote for who was going to be mayor. Chris Smith or Bill Brown. And so we had a mayoral election right there. And then they got into a discussion about why some of them were voting for Chris Smith and who wants better schools and Bill Brown, who wants to build a new stadium. Then they decided, much to my surprise, that they would have an election for my two dog characters who are sort of in the background of the book.
What age group are you trying to reach here?
Well, I was thinking as I did the book that it was probably going to be second, third, fourth, possibly fifth grade. I have discovered as I've gone around to schools that kindergarten teachers are using it and first grade teachers. And, you know, everybody uses it in a different way. I've discovered when I go to bookstores and I've got an audience of 2-year-olds and grandmothers and every age in between, that I take bits and pieces of the book and talk about it. So again, it's an interactive book.
Well, and perhaps in 10 or 15 years, we'll see a real upsurge in the number of young voters.
Well, that's my hope. The first time I talked about the book, it was a school in northern Vermont, and a young boy, probably a second grader, said to me, and the book hadn't been published then, but I was telling them that I was writing a book about voting, and he said, well, why would you write a book about voting? We can't vote. And the question really took me aback for a moment, and then I said, well, you know, it's not really that. It's maybe 10 years before you can vote, and that may seem like a lifetime to you at this point, but it's actually not that far away. But the other thing is, you can get your parents to go and vote. And if you have a parent who's saying, I'm just too tired to go to the polls, and you say, yeah, but let's go to the polls, you are, in effect, bringing in some voters.
Eileen, thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Eileen Christolo is the author of Vote. She joined us on the line from Dummerston, Vermont.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a Roman Catholic church just outside Boston is scheduled to close soon. We'll look at what activist members of the parish are doing to keep that from happening.
And in search of some good theater, head north to Canada. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Frank Stacio.
It's Here and Now.
Mortar fire killed at least 7 people and wounded at least 35 others on a busy street in Baghdad today. And U.S. forces continue to clash with Shiite militia forces in the holy city of Najaf. This, as AP reports, the leader of the Iraqi National Conference says that gathering has been extended for one day. The conference is meant to begin the democratic process in Iraq. It has been overshadowed by events in Najaf. Today, delegates from the assembly arrived in Najaf with a peace proposal to rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is New York Times reporter John Burns. Hello, John.
How are you?
What are the prospects for this mission?
Well, I think they've got a very steep mountain to climb. They are going to be asking Sadr to join the political process. It's plain that Sadr's ambitions go well beyond that. And that coming out of that shrine as they want him to, disarming his militia, would be to reduce himself in his own sense and in reality to a minor player in all of this. I can't see that happening.
Well, hanging over this mission, of course, is the prospect of U.S. military force. Marines are already in the city. I guess the question is, if the delegation fails and U.S. military might wins, what does that mean for Iraqis, the possibility of Iraqis governing themselves without U.S. force?
You know, I think Sadr is a very cunning fellow, and I think he knows that the kind of military force that would be required to get him out of that shrine is highly improbable, either American or Iraqi.
There's been a lot of attention on Najaf, of course, in recent days, but the fact is there has been a lot of fighting all around Iraq, and not much of that is getting back to the U.S. Can you give us an idea of what kind of military activity there is in the country?
Sadr has the ability to trigger a fairly widespread insurrection. There's argument about that word, but the fact is that Sadr has been able to tie down American troops and their Iraqi security allies in at least 8 other cities and towns across southern Iraq, all of the principal ones, Diwaniya, Kut, Hilla, Nasiriyah, Basra, Amara, and, of course, Sadr City outside of Baghdad. He has a lot of cards to play. He has thousands of people with weapons. There seems to be an almost inexhaustible pool of recruitment for Sadr amongst the impoverished Shiite underclass.
Where is he getting this support, and where is he getting his money?
Well, we know that some of the money, at least from American intelligence reports, and some of the weapons are coming from Iran. I personally have had experience down in the mosque in Kufa, adjacent to Najaf, also held by Sada, of seeing Iranian agents coming and going, and the history of Sada's movement and of his father's religious, if you will, history shows the very close associations with Iran. And then it gets more complicated than that. These ties tend to run to the hardline Ayatollahs in Iran who hold the Trump hand in Iranian politics.
Thank you, John.
It's a pleasure.
New York Times reporter John Burns spoke with us from Baghdad.
The Associated Press is among those reporting today that fighting is continuing in Najaf, but the AP does not mention any other Iraqi cities in its coverage, even as one line from yesterday's New York Times report noted that battles are currently being fought in every large city in southern Iraq. Well, joining us on the line is Eric Bollert, senior writer at Salon.com, who's been writing about what's happened to media coverage in Iraq after the handover of power on June 28th. And, Eric, why aren't we hearing more about the violence there, especially if the fighting is so widespread?
Well, it's an interesting question. And I think, you know, from a practical standpoint, I think it's difficult to get around the country and get to all these cities. It's extraordinarily dangerous. And, you know, most reporters are no longer embedded. But and I think also over time, it just the story becomes, in a strange way, as Iraq sort of teeters month by month into this chaos, it becomes harder and harder to package it for American news consumers as interesting or new. But I think what really changed the coverage was the June 28th, you know, handover of sovereignty. I mean, you could argue it had very little actual impact on the ground, and things have only gotten worse since then. But for some reason, it seems to me, it's my opinion, the press sort of took that lead from the administration. There's fundamentally something different that had changed. None of that makes sense when you consider there's still 138,000 troops there, and they're dying even at a higher rate than they were in June of this summer. But if you turn on the cable channels, not necessarily today or yesterday, but I would say anytime July over the last 6 weeks, you know, you'd probably get about 2 or 3 minutes at the top of the hour, and that was it.
So it sounds as if you're saying that there's not less coverage because there's less bad news. Things are just as bad as they were a few months ago, and we're just not hearing about it as
much. Yeah, I mean, for my piece, I talked to, you know, people who had been in Baghdad, reporters who were there, people who clearly pay a lot of attention to this, the CPA in Baghdad, and they said, you know, nothing has changed. If anything's changed, particularly on the security front, it's only gotten worse. And yet we see less coverage. And the other really strange phenomenon going on is if you listen to the pundits talk about the election, I mean, almost 90% will say the Iraq will be the deciding factor. So as we get closer to the election, you know, news consumers are getting less and less news about the story that they're told is going to decide the election.
And what's the big picture on casualties?
More people died in July after the handover, U.S.-American casualties, than died before the handover. And if you look at the casualty or fatality rate for August, all indications are that's going to be higher than July.
Well, in addition to casualties, what did you find as the real story that's being missed here?
Well, that the handover changed anything, really. You know, I talked to a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer who has done a couple tours of duty over there, and he was there in July, and he wrote a piece in August. And he said things aren't as bad as in Iraq as the press says they are. He says they're worse. He said, you know, Iraqis, even the most pro-Western Iraqis, have completely given up faith in America. The security situation is completely out of control. He used to go for jogs. He used to go to restaurants. No one leaves the green zone. He just didn't see any connection between what he was reading and seeing on the cable channels with what was actually going on in Baghdad.
Yeah, that's not a story we're hearing a lot. Why do you think it's important that this news continue to get our attention? You know, one more roadside bombing, one more assassination, even Heaven help us, one more kidnapping and beheading. Why is it important that we continue to focus on what's happening there?
We are going to be there for years. The repercussions are going to ripple for years. And so if Americans get the sense of, you know, we liberated Iraq, it's sort of messy, but we're going to come home and everything is fine, that's a false sense of security, because the people I talk to suggest this has given birth to an extraordinary amount of resentment, and that resentment may come back in very real terms, and Americans need to understand that we're not safer. We're probably less safe than we were.
Eric, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Eric Bollard is a senior writer at Salon.com.
Still to come, the perfect Olympic body according to the ancient Greeks.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Folks at the Miller Brewing Company thought it would be a good idea to promote their product by celebrating 50 years of rock and roll. And to that end, they decided to produce commemorative beer cans featuring 8 rock and roll legends. Turns out that none of those artists is black. An odd omission when you consider that 6 of the 10 original inductees to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1986 were black. Joining us on the line is William McKean. He's chairman of the University of Florida's Journalism Department and editor of the book Rock and Roll is Here to Stay. Welcome, Professor.
Hello.
Okay, here you go. 8 rock legends: Elvis Presley, Blondie, Alice Cooper, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, Willie Nelson, and pictures of the guitars of Eric Clapton and Joe Walsh. What's missing?
Bo Diddley, Little Richard, and, of course, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino. I would have put Bob Dylan on a can myself. It's an odd list.
Well, it is an odd list, and we can get to the race issue because it is important when you consider that, as I said, you know, 6 of the 10 first inductees were black, and the roots of this music is black. But you know, no Beatles, no Rolling Stones.
Right.
Where'd this list come from?
When I first heard about this list, I thought, that's very strange. I'm not trying to disparage Blondie, who provided, of course, many moments of listening satisfaction in the early 1980s, but I wouldn't put them on that list.
Then the other question, of course, how do you discuss the birth of rock and roll or 50 years of rock and roll without adding Ray Charles, Chuck Berry, James Brown?
You know, I've always thought that if he had wanted to go that direction, Ray Charles could have been the king of rock and roll. When you think of rock and roll as the blend of country and western and rhythm and blues, you always got to remember that there's some gospel in there, and nobody secularized gospel music or made more of a contribution to that than Ray Charles. Not to have Chuck Berry, who to me was the quintessence of early rock and roll, or Little Richard, or Bo Diddley, who's the most imitated artist in rock and roll. I don't know. I just don't see how you can pass up those guys.
Yeah, and I guess in fairness, Miller's not trying to do the complete history of rock and roll.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
Then how do you leave out Jimi Hendrix?
I was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last year, and a guy asked me one of his standard questions of people who write about rock and roll. He said, who are the 3 most important artists? And I said, Elvis, Bob Dylan, and Jimi Hendrix. If the Miller Brewing Company came out with a case of Bob Dylan beer cans, I know I'd be there to buy a few.
Well, I guess that's it. You're selling image when you sell beer, because here's a product that kills brain cells, damages the liver, and impairs judgment. So you're not selling it on the qualities of the product.
No, you're not.
Clearly, you have to make associations. And we've tried to reach Miller, and I sure wish we could talk to him about this. They haven't returned our phone calls. But they say that race was not a consideration. They just eliminated people who they thought would not appeal to Miller drinkers.
I don't want to disparage those artists. It's just that if you're celebrating 50 years of rock and roll, it ought to be representative artists.
All right, Professor McKean, thanks very much.
All right.
Professor William McKean of the University of Florida Journalism Department. Here and Now made repeated attempts to contact representatives of the Miller Brewing Company. They hadn't returned any of our phone calls or emails prior to our interview earlier this morning. However, just before airtime, we did get this statement from Miller. Quote, we regret any inference of the lack of African-American representation on the commemorative cans as being insensitive to diversity. Our original wish list included many legends, African-American and others, but regrettably we were unable to secure permissions. Obviously, African-Americans have played a huge role in the development of rock and roll, and in retrospect, we just didn't manage it appropriately. Our support for diversity is ongoing, as evidenced by the influential artists who are set to appear at our special 2-day concert that wraps up the promotion, featuring artists such as James Brown, Bo Diddley, Alice Cooper, Wyclef Jean, Lenny Kravitz, The Strokes, and Velvet Revolver, among others.
Stay with us. There's more ahead.
I'm Frank Stacio.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
On day 4 of the Athens Olympics, organizers are denying reports that they will give away thousands of free tickets. This amid growing concern at the site of events like tennis, gymnastics, soccer, and weightlifting being played in near-vacant stadiums. Games organizers say they still have 2 weeks to promote and sell the events. Meantime, American basketball star Allen Iverson has fractured his thumb, but he will reportedly play tonight's game against Greece. And American water polo team captain Wolf Weigo, whom we profiled last week, scored 4 goals in today's matchup against Kazakhstan, leading his team to a 9-6 victory.
Heracles was a demigod, son of Zeus and a mortal woman, celebrated for his athletic prowess and, well, his pecs.
I'm too sexy for my love, too sexy for my love. Love's going to leave me.
Move over, Ian Thorpe. The ancient Greeks gave us drama, philosophy, the Olympics, and as it turns out, they can take credit for contemporary culture's relentless obsession with body image. Christine Kondolian is curator of Greek and Roman art at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, where she recently put together the exhibit Games for the Gods, the Greek Athlete and the Olympic Spirit.
One thing that the visitors to this exhibit will notice right away is that all of the athletes are in the nude. No spandex, no gear, no foot gear, most importantly, despite our sponsor being New Balance. They ran barefoot.
Barefoot, naked, and slathered in oil. The museum's grouping of over 180 artifacts celebrates those fabulous ancient bods, as well as ceramic vases and jars for wine and olive oil, precious coins, an ancient trumpet made of bone and bronze, and of course, statues. Here and Now producer Andrea Shea recently toured the exhibit with curator Kondolian.
What we're looking at here is a life-size marble statue of the perfect Greek male nude, the type of image that populates museums throughout the world and reminds everyone of what is the heroic and idealized body of the Greek that we also admire now looking back 2,000 years. But in fact, he's much more than that. He is, in fact, an athlete, and that's an important discovery you make through this exhibition, that the male nude, immortalized by sculptors, they are great victors. And in this case, we see an individual who is caught in a moment of rest after his arduous competitions, and he's about to scrape the oil off himself. He's missing his arms, of course, but he's a type that we associate to a model that was made in the court of Alexander the Great by Lysippus, so in the 4th century model. And in fact, some of the best artists of 5th century and 4th century Greece were very charged up and inspired by these male bodies, and they reflect the fascination of their society in the perfection of the human form, in this case, a male form.
The athletes cover themselves in oil. Why do they do that?
Yes, well, in fact, this L.A. County piece that we're looking at, he's scraping the oil off his body, and he reflects a gesture that would have been necessary on the part of the athletes because in preparation for competition or exercise, indeed, any kind of exercise, they rub their bodies with virgin olive oil, which they believed was a conditioner for their skin, protected their skin from sunburn, prevented their pores from getting dirt into them. They didn't want to sweat. They didn't want to lose any essences, body fluids, because they thought that would deplete their strength. So the oil served many functions. But after all of this competition, they were sort of sweaty mess, and they scraped the oil and the sweaty mess off themselves with metal scrapers, which also did a kind of toning job on the body. But back to the idealization of the male body, which we see here in 2,000 pounds of marble, which was shipped from the Los Angeles County Museum. Originally was in London collections. Lansdowne went to the Hearst Castle and made its way finally to L.A. and now to Boston for this exhibition. And I think of him very much as the icon of the exhibition because he represents the striving for perfection that was the sine qua non of competition. And also the fact that an individual was victor. There were no second and third place winners, only first place winners. And this individual, in a sense, represents the arete, or the excellence, that the Greeks celebrated and strove for, aspired to. And arete, A-R-E-T-E, is a kind of virtue of excellence, and whether it's through competition in poetry, competition in music, competition in athletic events. So was it familial? Did athletes come from athletic families? Were they groomed from childhood? Yes. In fact, we have a perfect illustration to answer that question. We have a wonderful marble statue of a little boy, and if you look at his feet, they're quite tiny toes, and he has a baby belly, and his physiognomy would indicate that he's maybe a four-year-old, five-year-old, and he's standing beside a punching bag and holding dumbbells, so he's working out. And I think we can answer that they also were assigned trainers by their families. The more well-to-do families would hire professional trainers, former athletes themselves. And you see them represented on a lot of the Greek vases. They're cloaked, bearded to show they're older. They're not competing. They're cloaked and holding a stick, a willow branch with which they would call out the fouls and sometimes, ouch, hit the boys. And we have a lot of stories, ancient texts, that tell us about the families of athletes, so that a grandfather, a father, and brothers might be boxers and well known for this. And there's one great story of a woman who dressed herself as a man to accompany her son, a boxer, to Olympia, to the Games. She was, of course, forbidden on pain of death to enter, but she presented herself as a male trainer of her son, and she was, in fact, the trainer, we think, of the son. And when her son won the competition, she was so excited, she jumped over the barrier and revealed herself to be a woman, at which point the judges at Olympia condemned her to death. But we know that she didn't get put to death because, why? Her father was a prize victor boxer, her two brothers were, and her son was. So she had produced a good gene pool, came from a good gene pool, and they weren't going to put an end to that. So there is this kind of history of family athletes. And what was the ultimate prize? The ultimate prize was the glory of victory, kleos. The Greek word kleos, K-L-E-O-S, means glory. And arete, excellence, and kleos were the major virtues to which you aspired in your male life. And there was no higher calling than to receive glory. And the only other place outside of the battlefield to achieve that glory was in the athletic games. And in fact, we have the words of the ancient Greeks themselves. In the case of Solon, 6th century legislator from Athens, he writes, "We, the Greeks, do not look at the prizes which are handed out. Together with them goes a reputation which is worth everything to the victors. And getting kicked is a small price to pay for those who seek fame through pain. So no pain, no gain."
Christine Condolian curated Games for the Gods, the Greek Athlete and the Olympic Spirit, at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston.
I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes I've made a few. I've had my shouts and kicks in my face, but I've come through.
And I need to go home.
Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Frank Stacio.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, here and now.
My bows and my curtain calls. You
brought me fame and fortune and everything that goes with it. I thank you all. But it's been no better.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.